When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, reader. I'm Cindy Burnett. Welcome to my award-winning podcast, Thoughts from a Page, which is a member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. On the show, I chat with authors whose books I have enjoyed about their new releases, and I give you a peek behind the curtain of the publishing industry with my Behind the Scenes series. With so many books coming out weekly, it can be hard to decide what to read, so I find the best ones and share them with you. If you're looking for a community of readers, bonus content, and a chance to read books before they hit the shelves, I hope you'll consider joining my Patreon group, which is filled with a wonderful bunch of book lovers. The link to join is in the show notes. Today, I am chatting with Catherine Ray about the Berlin Letters. Catherine is a national best-selling and award-winning author who has enjoyed a lifelong affair with books. She publishes both fiction and nonfiction, holds a BA and MS from Northwestern University, and currently lives outside Chicago, Illinois, with her husband. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome, Catherine. How are you today?
Fine, thank you, Cindy. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm so glad that you are here as well. And I really enjoyed the Berlin Letters. I can't wait to talk about it.
Wonderful. I appreciate that. Thanks.
Well, why don't we start out with you giving me a quick synopsis of the book?
Okay. So the book is about a young woman, Louisa Vogler, who works for a top secret CIA code-breaking project, but stumbles across a code that reminds her of a childhood experience. And she comes to find that her grandfather was a spy for the CIA in East Germany, and that her father, whom she has long presumed dead, may still be alive and languishing in a Stasi prison. And this all takes place in the first week of November, before the fall of the wall, November 9th, 1989. And she impetuously decides to drop everything and break her father out of an East German prison. So it is a race of a story. It's a chase. It's, you know, a spy story, but it's also a family love story, a father and daughter love story. It was a lot of fun to write and a really interesting page in history to study. So that's a little bit about the Berlin Letters.
How did you become interested enough in this time period to write about it?
My last book took me to Cold War Moscow, where I had two women, one working for the CIA and one working for MI6. And during that research, because that book spanned from 1955 to 1985, so I did a ton of Cold War research, and I really sort of stumbled upon the Berlin Wall, both as an iconic symbol of the Cold War, but also as a really big wall that separated families for 28 years. And that was intriguing and compelling. And if you look on, you know, if you Google Berlin Wall 1961, you see some extraordinary pictures of that first day. And when I sort of studied some of those pictures, I just started to make stories up because I had questions of what happened. So that's how it began.
Well, I think it's fascinating because of the age we are, we remember when the wall came down. I mean, that's something that I vividly remember, all sorts of chatter about it. But I wasn't as familiar with what happened when the wall went up. And I thought that was really interesting in your book, that first it was barbed wire in a day, or really in a night, I guess, they woke up and all of a sudden this barbed wire was surrounding West Berlin, which I also thought was fascinating because you always think about the wall keeping people in versus not allowing them to leave. And so I just felt like I learned a lot from reading your book.
Yeah, that it was fascinating. It was called Operation Rose. And you're right. It went up in a single night. 65,000 people on that following day, on that Monday morning, could not walk across the street and go to work anymore. They lost their jobs. It really cut off families. You know, there are stories of, say, a child spending the night with their grandparents on the east side and not being able to go home the next morning. Like, absolutely true. And you're also right that it was a little bit more of keeping people in the sense that West Berlin was completely surrounded, but West Berlin was completely surrounded by East Germany. It was sort of a free island in the middle of a communist sea. And the problem is that from 1945 to 1961, when the wall went up, 2.6 million East Germans came to Berlin, walked across the street to the west side and left. It was an escape hatch. And they needed to close that because the economy was crashing.
I found all of that completely fascinating and actually a little embarrassing because I don't think I really realized that Berlin was in the middle of East Germany. And I was like, okay, Cindy, like, get with it with your geography. But I was curious about the escape hatch part of it because they all came to West Berlin. And then did they leave by train and by plane? I mean, what did that look like?
Yes. In 1945, Berlin was divided into four sectors. And it was the Soviet Union had one, France had one, the United Kingdom had one, and so did the U.S. And the agreement was that there would be free movement between the four sectors. So an East German could go to Berlin and, yes, walk across into any of those Western sectors, which were all sort of governed together, and they could leave. They could take a flight out. They could take a train out, but they could get out. And so it really was this escape hatch. You might have had to show papers when you left the Soviet sector, but you could not, according to the rules, be stopped until the Berlin Wall went up. Now, it violated the Yalta Agreement, but the West decided it was not worth going to war for, and so none of them vehemently protested it.
Which I also thought was interesting, but I guess they were so nervous after World War II, nobody wanted another war. But it's interesting that they didn't protest that.
No, they really didn't. The really extraordinary story, and it's in the book too, happened on October 17th, I think, when like 18 Soviet tanks rolled up on one side and 18 U.S. tanks rolled up on the other. And they really did think they were going to go to war. It was a standoff for about 24 hours of all of these tanks with guns pointed at each other. And do look that up. It's an extraordinary picture, too. So it really, Berlin was sort of a hotbed of strife. And nobody wanted to, you know, light that match and set this off for World War III.
I love that you included details like that. And I really do need to Google it, actually, because I would be fascinated to see the actual photos of that. But also the homes that sat on the east side, but when you walked out their front door, they went into the west side. I didn't know that it existed. And I love that you incorporated that and that that created a problem for the wall initially.
It did, because the wall was set back about 10 feet so that the West could not protest it, meaning that like not a single inch was on the side of West Berlin, that soil. So East Berlin said they were fully in their rights to do that. But it ran into these apartment buildings. And you're right, it stops. And then those apartment buildings, there was no wall. They were the wall because they were right there. And then it would start again on the other side. But on that first day, people were just walking out their front doors, one step, and they were in West Berlin. So those doors were bricked up pretty quickly. And then you can look at photos, and people started sort of jumping out first, second, and third floor windows. And they would notify the West Berlin Fire Department first so that tarps could be brought over to catch them. Now, I'm sounding like a ton of people did that. Not a ton of people did. But you can see the photos. And very quickly, all of those windows were bricked up. People were moved off of that street, out of those buildings, and a buffer zone was created.
And that's one of the things I love about historical fiction, is that I learn all these details that I would have never encountered elsewhere, or at least I haven't encountered elsewhere. And it's in the middle of this story that keeps me turning the pages. So I was really glad you incorporated some of those.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I have to tell you, it's so much better to use fact than fiction, because often it's more compelling and most times it's more shocking. So it's really nice to be able to include the real stuff.
Exactly. Truth is always stranger than fiction. So let's talk a little bit more about your research. Obviously, we've talked a little bit about it with some of the things we've discussed, but was there anything else in your research that surprised you or things that you couldn't include?
So much I couldn't include, because the story comes first, and it certainly is not supposed to be a research dump by any means. It's supposed to be, you know, a fabulous story that gives just enough that is compelling for the characters to move on with. So there was a lot. What I did find surprising, though, were just the little details, like the doors to nowhere, which I talk about in the book. And when I went to East Berlin, or Berlin, and walked over to what was formerly East Berlin, I saw them. And basically what happened was, during World War II, you know, a building was bombed, it crumbled, and the building next to it, or part of the building that remained, they just left the doors. I'm assuming from the inside of the building they are bricked up, but from the outside, there are doors on the fourth, fifth, sixth floors that still look like doors, doors to nowhere. And so it was really neat to see those things, because they added texture to the story, and they are real, and they were just little surprising tidbits.
And I should know this as well, but is there much of the wall left at all?
Not really, no. There are absolutely, like, Potsdamer Platz, there are a few sections, there are a few sections here and there near Bernauer Strasse, which is the buildings we were talking about. That is where the big wall museum is. And so there's quite a stretch there, including a buffer strip section and the little wall. We don't really from the West realize that, but the wall wasn't one thing. We think it was this huge 10-foot wall, but really it was that, then this huge death zone or buffer strip. And then there was a littler wall, 6 feet high, on the East German side. So that wall still remains along that street as well as part of the wall museum. But no, there is, however, along the roads, two bricks that are laid out in a line that is exactly where the wall was. And you can walk that sort of brick path.
Okay, that's really cool. And the wall you were describing, the different aspects of it, that came over time. I mean, they had the barbed wire, then they built the 10-foot wall. And then as people kept trying to escape, they kept fortifying it. Is that correct?
Yes. And so after the barbed wire, it actually became a 6-foot wall for quite a while. And then the 10-foot wall wasn't put into place. The one that we see with its slick pipe along the top, that wasn't put into place until the late 70s, early 80s. It was finished. It took 4 years to put in that final iteration of the wall. And it was its fourth iteration. And that was finished in 1980, I believe. And so you're right. That is one aspect of it. But then in that buffer zone, that continued to change over time too. There was one point where they had automatic firing rifles within the buffer zone pointed to the east at their own people. But they needed money from West Germany at one point. I think it was in the 70s. And the West German said, take out the automatic rifles, we'll give you the $1 billion you need. And they did. And so that changed too. But they also had like a strip of metal shards called Hochspurnen, which were translated to dragon's teeth. And so if you took off across that death strip, either this, they'd see your footprints in the sand, you'd get torn up by the metal shards, the guard posts and the guards would get you. Or, as I said, in the final iteration, they had a very slick metal pipe along the top so that people couldn't easily get over the top of the wall.
Can you imagine how harrowing it would be to even attempt to get through all of that?
No.
I know, it's like,
Did read about a few attempts, and no, I cannot imagine.
Well, how did you decide on a dual timeline format?
I wanted the book really to be Luisa's story and to be that sort of chase in that final week of the Berlin Wall. However, I wanted also not only to sort of pull the curtain back on East Berlin at that time, but I wanted to create more of a love story. And so Harris not only gives us what it was like to be behind the wall, but also I love his transformation and his love for his daughter. So it really, the dual time, you know, points of view allowed me to create sort of a synergy between, so that I got both history and character growth and a love story. All good things.
Yes. And it provided the setup for Louisa's story too.
Yes. And yes. And then the reader was a part of the setup. Otherwise, it's just backstory.
Exactly. Well, we talked about what surprised you in the research. What surprised you in the writing?
You know how quickly it went, really. Once I got all the elements in place, and when I write a story, I consider it sort of like a skeleton. Once I have the element of, say, the head and the shoulders and the hips and the knees and the feet, then I start to write it. And once I had those elements, it really did become a race. And so I was experiencing this fun and this sort of chase and writing it as Louisa is experiencing this finding the letters and deciding to go to Berlin and dressing up as punk and trying to get her father out. And so this novel, more than any I've written, became sort of that chase feeling. So that was a surprise and a delight in many ways.
Yes, absolutely. If it's going quickly versus sitting there thinking, what do I write next?
Exactly. It's never fun.
No, I can't imagine that it would be. Well, in the Cold War, that just seems like it's becoming a very popular time to write about. Why do you think that is?
I think we've been in World War II literature for, gosh, almost a decade now. And that has been wonderful. But I think publishers and readers are looking at, you know, where are the interesting stories from other time periods? And I think Cold War is one of them. It's a huge swath of history. A lot happened. And it's an intriguing time in history because the two superpowers never went head to head. There were all these side skirmishes and intrigues. And so it's a really a fascinating time.
It really is. And I think you're right. People enjoy World War II, but there's been a lot of stories. And so it's nice to have something different to read about. And it's a long time period. You know, you think the Cold War and it's one thing, but it's really not. And there were various times when it heated up more, when it settled down, and so many different countries were involved on different levels. So yes, it is so interesting, I think, and kind of hard for us to understand completely.
I think that is true. And you're right. I mean, boy, 1945 to 1947, you could say it started, definitely went all the way to 1991. But did it really end? Not entirely sure. So it encompasses so much. And it encompasses so much intrigue and the moving of chess pieces across the board, the global board. I mean, it really is. I mean, what? That's over half a century of history.
Exactly. And I agree with that. And you're right. I mean, it hasn't completely ended because there are still so many things happening or ramping back up. But the other thing that always intrigues me when I read about Russia and the countries that became part of the Soviet Union bloc is how ruling by intimidation is their method and how you just find enough people that will cooperate with that. Because as soon as people start saying, no, I'm not going to do that, things fall apart. And why does it take so long for that to happen?
You know, I think fear is one thing. And then I'm going to use the analogy of boiling a frog, if you've ever heard that. I've never actually done that, by the way. I just mean it's an old story. And the old story is that if you put a frog in cool water and you warm it up, the frog would not jump out. But if you tried to drop a frog in boiling water, this is a terrible analogy, it would jump out right away. And my point is that I think in many ways, the heat was turned up. And you make concessions and you don't quite realize you've made those concessions until really the situation is quite dire. And then it's hard to turn back the clock. And you're in, as a culture, you're in pretty deep and you're pretty darn afraid. And so you're right. You need those courageous people. I think it's human nature to want to think the best and not realize when things are going wrong very quickly. And that's a good aspect of us, I think, but perhaps maybe a little naive, I guess. I don't know.
Well, and Harris, I mean, that's his arc. He believes in the Soviet way and what they're doing and what they want to do. But then over time, he slowly realizes this isn't the right way. Well, did you have a highlight of writing the book?
The punk scene.
Okay, so tell me about that.
Okay, so it's in many ways, it was my little nod to like Pretty Woman. And if you remember in that movie, when Julia Roberts goes into the store and she just, you know, dresses up and she leaves with confidence, et cetera. Well, Louisa goes into a club in West Berlin and she trades places with a punk drummer. They have to swap identities. And she dresses up. It's not in any way that she would dress up. And this is much a more dire situation. But it was such a fun way to introduce the punk culture, which was so different on the eastern side of the wall than the western side of the wall. And it was really, I thought, a interesting way to get Louisa through the wall. So I really had a lot of fun with that. And that is a real club, SO36. I made up the band's name, but absolutely the punk culture was, you know, alive, thriving, and on the East, definitely pointing a finger at the regime and saying, we will not follow your rules.
Do you like punk music?
Not really, no.
You're like, I just got to write about them, but I didn't need to listen.
I did. I listened to a little bit just so I understood, but no, not really.
Well, I always love to hear about the title and the cover because I feel like so much goes into them and people don't always realize that. So tell me a little bit about first how the title came about and then the cover.
The title came about from the very beginning, the Women in the Venona 2 Project. And that is where Louisa works. And that is based on a real group called the Venona Project that worked from 1943 to 1980. And they were decoding old Soviet Cold War and World War II codes. And I imagine that it went on, and that's where Louisa is. But they named all their batches, and her friend Carrie has a batch out of Berlin that she calls the Berlin Letters. And this leads to actually finding a bunch of real letters. So that is the title I came up with. And to be honest, this is my 11th book. I've only titled my first novel and my 11th novel. I've never titled a book in the middle. So kind of fun, it stuck.
That is fun because titles are tricky and you can feel like you have a great title. And then you get to working with the publisher and somebody's like, yeah, this title's not going to work.
Right. So the Berlin Letters actually worked. And the cover, okay, I love the cover. So the cover, the first iteration of the cover that they showed me was a little bit of the Berlin Wall with the Brandenburg Gate in the background. And Louisa was standing there with a scarf on her head in a crowd of people. And I was like, I don't know where in the world I am. Yeah, it wasn't immediately recognizable because although, you know, the Brandenburg Gate isn't one of those iconic symbols like the Eiffel Tower. You don't see it right away and know necessarily where you are, especially when it's behind a wall and you're only seeing the top of it. And then they showed me this one and they said, well, we don't really like this one, but here you go. And I was like, oh my goodness, no, that's it. Because there is a yellow Trabi, which was the only car you could buy in East Germany at the time. There's a yellow Trabi in the book, a Trabant. And Louisa, though in the original one they showed me, she had her hands behind her back and she was leaning a little more provocatively against the car. I was like, well, unfortunately, this woman's all business. Louisa cannot be leaning back on the car. She probably needs to be crossing her hands in front of her because she's on a mission. And so they changed up the model and she looks just like I imagined Louisa.
I love hearing that as well, because I know it can be frustrating if you have a cover for your book that you've spent all this time on and you're like, I don't really like it very much.
Yeah, I love this cover. Absolutely love it. In fact, here was the hilarious thing. At the end, my editor sent me catalog shots of different skirts and sweaters and scarves, and I got to pick Louisa's wardrobe, which was so fun.
Oh, that had to be fun.
That is, in the book, she wears a brown sweater at one point with a hand-knit scarf and a dark green wool skirt. It was kind of fun.
Yeah, that's very fun. You're like, thank you.
Yeah.
And you know, you raised something that I thought about a minute ago, and then we went a different direction. The coding. You also have a significant portion of the story that relates to decoding and the way codes were used during the Cold War. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, codes were used in many different ways. The idea for these codes came from, as I said, the Venona Project. And that was back in World War II, after the USSR switched sides and joined the Allies, there was a military intelligence officer who wasn't quite sure we should be trusting Joseph Stalin. So he hired a group of primarily women to start peeking into Joseph Stalin's mailbag to look at the codes, the secret communiques he was sending all around the world, because we were already collecting them all. We just weren't reading Allied messages. So anyway, I looked at how those codes were constructed, and they are constructed using a ton of math. They're numeric. And so when I was writing the Berlin letters, I thought that is not going to be fun for readers. So I did some research on codes and I used acrostic codes and shift codes so that readers could also follow the code within the letters that I put in the book. So that is absolutely not accurate Soviet coding, but it does make it a little more fun. But basically, you know, secret messages being sent everywhere. And during the Cold War, you know, they would send them out in pens or in film canisters. Let's see, journalists were not searched. And so they often sent journalists in the latter days of the Berlin Wall standing out with messages within their film canisters. So really interesting stuff. Now they would probably use high-tech gear, but back then it was pen and paper.
Well, exactly. It would be on some little tiny, tiny drive that could just be snuck through however.
Exactly.
You must have spent a while on the code aspects of the book.
I did. And I did not use any AI because they didn't have AI in 1989. So I developed them all myself with pen and paper, which was really a lot of fun. But I needed to not only make them authentic for how codes, certain types of codes were written, but I wanted to make them accessible to the reader. And I wanted to know exactly how they were constructed. So you're right. The history of coding didn't play a big significant role in the book, but I definitely did a lot of research on it.
Yes, exactly. You used the codes, but you didn't have to get involved in how codes were developed or anything like that.
Yeah.
Well, Catherine, before we wrap up, what have you read recently that you really liked?
I've read a few books I've really enjoyed. I loved Linda Cohen-Logman wrote a book called The Matchmaker's Gift, and I really enjoyed that.
I love that book. I hosted her for a literary salon here in Houston, and then I hosted an early read for my Patreon group where we read it early through NetGalley and then met with her, and everybody loved that book. Both groups just thought it was fabulous.
It was charming. It was absolutely charming. I loved it. So I'm so glad you did too. I also read recently Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, and I know I'm late to the party, but wow, was that writing incredible. Absolutely loved that book.
I've heard it's great. I'm such a wimp about children dying, so I usually avoid those stories, but I've heard nothing but beautiful things about that story.
It's incredible, and her prose is amazing. So those are two I've absolutely loved lately.
And I've read all of her earlier books, but I have not read any of her historical fiction, which is funny because I'm kind of known for historical fiction.
Yeah. She's just come out with one that I need to pick up.
That's right. And then Linda has a book coming out in the fall.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. That makes me happy.
I know. Very exciting. Well, it was so fun to talk with you, Catherine. Thank you for taking the time to come on the Thoughts from a Page podcast.
Thank you. I've loved this. So nice connecting with you.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.
Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, genxgrownup.com. Life sucks as a grown-up. All right, you think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right.
I've never done it.
Right.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I would love to connect with you on Instagram or Facebook, where you can find me at Thoughts from a Page. If you enjoy the show, please consider joining my Patreon group to access bonus content and support the podcast. If you have a moment to rate the show or subscribe to it wherever you listen to your podcasts, I would really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. And please tell all of your friends about Thoughts from a Page. Word of mouth does wonders to help the show grow. The book discussed in this episode can be purchased at my bookshop storefront, and the link is in the show notes. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor. So while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.